You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske and Sam Gardner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today we are talking about taking on leadership roles outside of statistics. And Sam is interviewing Shanti, who has quite a lot of experience, both inside and outside of statistics. So stay tuned for this nice interview. There are lots of further resources on our homepage around leadership, influencing, data visualization. So check out the homepage, The Effective Statistician, and find much more content there. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today.
Today we have a special guest, Dr. Shanti Setharaman of Eli Lilly and Company. Shanti has over 25 years of experience in the pharmaceutical industry in the fields of statistical thinking and applications, and she's held various positions across the statistics organization, CMC, Chemistry, Manufacturing, and Controls Group, regulatory, and project management. She's currently the senior director for the Diabetes Complications Statistics Group at Eli Lilly and Company. She joined Lilly after obtaining her PhD from Virginia Tech. One of her passions is leadership development, and she is a champion of that at Lilly. So Shanti, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me over.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
And just in the interest of full disclosure, Shanti is a good friend. I've known her for 20 years. She hired me initially in my first job in the pharmaceutical industry, one of the biggest mistakes she ever made.
I wouldn't say that, actually. No, on the contrary, it was great having you with your applications and your knowledge and training and your enthusiasm and passion for pharmaceuticals. That is what is so neat.
Yeah. And so Shanti's been my boss. She's been a mentor and a friend for over 20 years. And she's got a really interesting career path that she's had in pharmaceuticals. And I think you'll be interested to hear it. So first of all, just, you know, you got your PhD in statistics. How did you decide just to study statistics? What was your motivation for that?
Yeah, actually, my undergraduate was in mathematics and I was interested in that. But then later on, I got exposed to courses in operations research and statistics. And I realized that I actually like the concept of working on a variety of problems. That's who I am. And I felt like statistics actually had a broad spectrum of potential applications across many fields. And I experienced that through the consulting lab, actually, at the Department of Statistics at Virginia Tech, where we would be consulting across different departments. You know, it could be mechanical engineering, industrial engineering, veterinary science. And so I really, really like the variety there.
Yeah. And I know Virginia Tech has a real strong applied statistics focus too, right? In their programs.
That is correct. And that consulting lab, I mean, they actually put in a lot of effort into that so that the statisticians can actually get that kind of experience that they need. And then they can decide, you know, whichever way they want to go, because you could still go into academia and still have a consulting lab in that university, or you can go to other industries.
Right. And so you got your degree and then your first job was working for Lilly. Is that right?
Well, kind of. My experience prior to Lilly was actually a summer intern at DuPont. And we were actually manufacturing pantyhoses at the time. So I kind of know more about the pantyhose now than I ever did before. It was very interesting, though. But that gave me actually insights into an industry environment, which I seemed to like more than being in academia. And so it was not like I was looking for a pharma job. What happened is after I graduated, a friend of mine who had also graduated from Virginia Tech had gotten a job at Lilly. And she had reached out to me to see if I would be interested in a development manufacturing project statistician job at Lilly. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And at the time, a job was a job for me. So I was very excited. And that ended up with me joining Lilly. And actually, I'm glad, and I stayed at Lilly for so long and I never moved, is because it was great to see, you're actually part of the solution in real setting in terms of what you're doing. But at the same time, you could also publish depending on the intensity and the breadth of the solution. So it was like, I felt like I had the best of both worlds, where I could see real setting applications and being able to publish. Plus, I feel like Lilly has a very great infrastructure to be very successful. And to this day, I really feel blessed being in this place.
Yeah, it was a great place to work. It was a great place for me to start my, really my professional career as a statistician is where it started there at Lilly. And it was really good, the experiences I had there. So you started out in a sort of a, not the traditional statistics role. You were in the non-clinical statistics, and in particular in the chemistry, manufacturing, and controls area. So did you think that was strange, or did that just seem natural to you to do?
Oh, it was very strange, because I was actually a senior statistician in this development and manufacturing division of Lilly. And I was the only statistician at that site, where you joined later on, Sam. And there are about like 1,200 employees, and they're working at various areas, you know, chemical process and analytical development labs, quality control labs, regulatory, manufacturing, environment control. So it was like it being the only statistician in the midst of all the chemists and engineers that you would find. It was daunting. And we also had at the time, if you remember, we had both human and animal health manufacturing at the time. So it is like, you know, you were just drinking from a hose at the time, from a fire hose. So, but it was very enjoyable, because you learned a lot through that. And at the time, actually, I had a mentor. My first mentor was actually Gary Sullivan. And he was at corporate at the time. So, and he used to support the site. So it was great to have him, as he was teaching me the things about the site, about the business and the people. And at the time, he was also trying to teach me about leadership.
Yeah, Gary's been involved. He's been on the podcast before, and he and Alexander and myself are actually together conducting the Effective Statistician Leadership Program as well. And so, and that's something you can go on to theeffectivestatistician.com and read about. It's a good training program for statisticians to learn how to be a better leader in your environment. So you, speaking of leadership and I guess management, so you were the lone statistician at the site, but you had backup. You know, you had other statisticians that were doing similar things, just at different locations.
Yes.
But then you started to get people working underneath you. So you started to hire people. What was the motivation for that? Why did that happen?
What happened actually was, you know, even though it was a development and manufacturing site, there was a lot of tech transfers going on from the site to other areas outside the site, sites in Ireland and in other places. And in the first 4 to 5 years, I was the only statistician, but I think people started seeing the importance of statistical thinking. And we used to have Gary and some of the people from corporate also come to the site. And as a result, I think they saw the applications, they saw that they also required training. They realized that we were able to identify potential problems before even they happened. And then there were problems that happened where we were able to help them solve. So as a result, it became important to the folks, even at the site, it became evident to them that we needed to have a group. And that's kind of where, you know, you came in, Sam. And there, when I was hiring also, I was looking for people who not only just had statistics, but they had other field of interest that they've had some experience. And you had a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and that was even more important for me at the time, because you could speak the language. And that was something very important, to say that how can one speak the language of the people that we're actually helping with. So as a result, we actually ended up in the next year and a half, I think we actually employed 4 additional people. So we were a group of 5 at the time.
Yeah. I was there when that was happening. It was an interesting time. And surprisingly, we still had more work to do than we could possibly do.
True.
Yeah.
True.
So you were all by yourself originally, and then took 4 more people to come in and fill in the gaps, and it still wasn't enough. So I think it just shows where in this area of non-clinical statistics, and really anywhere where statisticians can get involved, there are always more problems to solve than there are statisticians.
Yes, and one thing I would add there, Sam, is the more we try to understand the area, the better is our impact. So, you know, as you know, there were quality control laboratories. We had all kinds of analytical development, and we needed to understand the science behind it, and then we would have an impact there. We had regulatory submissions on the CMNC side, and we needed to understand the regulatory guidelines, and we had an impact there. So I think the impact comes from how much we are able to understand. You know, I think this is what Gary and you call as business acumen in when you're teaching the effective statistician. I think that becomes an integral part of it.
Yeah, that's a critical element of being influential and being effective. So you did this, and you were leading a moderate-sized team at the site, and then you moved on to a higher level of management. Tell us about that. What was that role?
So I think I was at Tippecanoe Laboratories for about 10 years, and after that, Lilly decided to sell the site to another company, and we transitioned from there to other areas. So I actually got the role of the Director of Global Manufacturing Statistics at Corporate Center, and this was actually a role that Gary held at the time. And so I realized that this director job was going to be much bigger, because this was manufacturing across, because the site that I was at, we were at, was mainly an active pharmaceutical ingredient site for small molecules. But this, a director job, was global manufacturing across APIs and drug product and parenteral. So it was much bigger from that standpoint. And that's how I got that role.
Right. And the size of the team, what size was that team when you took
over? You know, you're asking me to remember. We may have had about 10 or 12 people there at the time.
So you doubled, or a little bit more than doubled, the number of reports that you had, and broadened your scope globally, really, across the whole company. Okay. When you took that on, was there anybody that was influential in helping you make that decision to take on that role?
Actually, it was a combination. It was both Gary and my supervisor. There was a supervisor at the time. And I think his thinking was, okay, you've been a group leader for so long. You know, if you really like this, and if you have a passion of developing people and learning more, you know, try to get outside your comfort zone, was his statement, my supervisor's. And so I really think that having a good supervisor and a good mentor is very important. And I think both of them were highly influential in this.
And you were in that role for how long? How many years were you?
I was in that director role for about 4 years before I moved out of that role.
Okay. And then you made a kind of a perpendicular move in your career. You took on another role that was a little bit different than being in statistics. What was that?
So actually what happened was, in addition to having a couple of mentors within the statistics group, I also had mentors outside of statistics group. This person was actually a vice president of the small molecule API development and manufacturing area. And so he and I used to chat. And when I was in this director role in manufacturing, he was actually the vice president for early phase development for small molecules. So we would continue to chat, and I used to share with him, you know, because most of the time, right, the processes come from development into manufacturing. So it was cool to talk to him about the issues, the opportunities, and what's happening during tech transfers. And during that conversation, we used to also talk about, you know, how do we train the chemists and engineers a little bit more with respect to statistical thinking, and mainly around variability, because it is fascinating, because when people run experiments in the lab, sometimes variability is not something that they would be thinking about. So when we were having a chat about that and talking about this, he started thinking about, in his leadership, because he had a lot of chemists and engineers in his group, in his leadership, he wanted to have somebody with a statistical thinking mindset. So he offered me the job of being a director in his group. So that's how I kind of got that job, and had chemists and engineers in the group.
Right. So you had no statisticians reporting to you then?
No.
We're all chemists, chemical engineers. Right.
Yes.
So did that surprise people?
Actually, there were a few that people thought, kind of, what is wrong with me? It's like, why would you do this? And of all, you don't know chemistry, you don't know chemical engineering, and why in the world would you take this job? But I, even though they were surprised about this, I felt it was actually great, because we go in and our training is to ask questions, right? We ask, and those asking these questions actually were helping the chemists and engineers because we kind of take things for granted otherwise. And that actually helped them. But there were people even in his own organization, I think they were a little surprised, but I think it did take a turn.
Right. Did you get any resistance? I mean, all these people that are reporting to you now, you know, they probably were used to having a chemist being their boss, and now they've got a statistician. Did you have anybody kind of, resistant to that, or did you face any challenges with that?
Great question, Sam. And yes, I did. There were some people, I mean, it was like a distribution, you know, you'd find quite a few people who were like, okay, you know, I don't mind having her around and she's going to be asking me questions and I don't know statistics, she's going to help me. And then there were people like, who the heck is she? She's not a chemist or an engineer. Why should I be even listening to you? So those are the people you need to build trust by letting them know, yeah, I'm not here to be a chemist or an engineer, right? I'm here to help you with your development and to understand the process and then to make the connections across the different sites, which is what I brought to the table. And I think that took a little bit of time. So there were some people who were probably wondering what I was thinking and why I was even in the first place. And then there were some people who were very soon saw that, it's great to actually have a statistician in that role.
Okay. And so then you did that for a while. You did that for how many years were you in that?
I was there only for a couple of years, actually.
And then you moved on to something else. What was the next thing you did?
Yeah, after that, I got an opportunity to go. A new job came up, actually. A new position was created as the Director of Regulatory Intelligence in the Global Regulatory Affairs. And my vice president at the time in CMNC had actually put my name forth to say, okay, you know, she can go lead that. I was actually not wanting to move because I didn't know anything about regulatory intelligence. And, you know, this was like no clue. I didn't know the vice president in that area. I didn't know people in that area as much. I knew the CMNC regulatory scientists, but not the rest of them. And this was all you'd be dealing with the clinical regulatory scientists. I was very apprehensive and I didn't want to go to that position. But then what I did was I said, okay, let me just go explore. And so I talked to a few people out there and then I decided, okay, this may not be a bad thing to do. This is a very different opportunity where you have to build a new group from ground up. So I said, okay, I will take the challenge and see if I can do it.
Right. Did you face any challenges there, any resistance? Or tell me, how did that role go? What was it like?
I didn't feel any resistance. I mean, I think the infrastructure was actually fantastic. People were very helpful. They understood this was a new position. The challenge there was for me to, first of all, build a group and then create the strategy for the vision and mission of regulatory intelligence and to integrate the regulatory landscape information into submission and approval. So, you know, you're basically trying to help the regulatory scientists get information that's out there, bring it in, and then see, you know, like what kind of information from previous submissions that's available publicly, and how do you mine that kind of data and utilize it internally. So it was a big challenge because it was a huge learning curve for me. Creating a group was not easy, but it was very rewarding because you get to pick and choose who you want in that group. So you could actually build a diverse set of skills in that group. So I think that was great, actually being able to do that.
Yeah. And so it sounded like you were able to apply some statistical ideas or at least some data science ideas in that role.
Yes, actually we built certain tools and techniques so that the regulatory scientists can also become self-sufficient in terms of how to mine the data and what information to look for and how they can actually utilize that data to their own projects.
Cool. That's really neat. That's really neat. So you're in that role and then you got an opportunity to do something else?
Yeah, I was there for a couple of years. And then that's where I got exposed to the clinical side of the clinical drug development. And that really intrigued me. And so I started pursuing a role in project management. And the reason is in the project management role, you can actually see, especially if you're in the early phase from preclinical to phase two, you can actually see all the different aspects to it. And it was actually very helpful for me to see that and see how a clinical trials were actually being run and what goes into it. And even though it was project management, you do get into some of the details around the technicality.
And when you say project management, what was the scope of the project? I mean, what aspects of the different of the projects were you involved with leading and managing?
So it was like there was technical, operational, and strategic pieces to it. Okay, the technical was around, you know, as a statistician, you'll be looking at the data, the preclinical data, and when you're looking at toxicology data and trying to say, okay, what do we need to do for phase one? That's where some of the technical aspects came. The operational was around making sure that, you know, things were run within budget and we had appropriate funding and which sites and what are some of the problems there and how do you handle those problems for those, because the things have to be done in a timely manner too in order to deliver the trial. And strategic was around, you know, making decisions or help with the team trying to make decisions. And this is where the benefit risk comes into play in terms of, you know, do we have sufficient information to go forward? And if you have two other molecules, which one makes most sense to go forward? And how do you put forth that kind of information? So this is what I loved about the job, is you had all the three aspects that you were learning and being able to.
Okay. And then you came back to statistics, or at least formally to the statistics organization. And you've been in this role, that's the same role you're in now. You're the senior director for the diabetes complications group. And talk, what's kind of the scope of your, what does that group work on?
So this is interesting because this is actually clinical now, right? So I started with non-clinical, I ended up in the clinical. So the group is a group of clinical project statisticians where we look through the phase one all the way through submission and approval for medicines or drugs and diabetes complications. So it basically spans disease states, type 1, type 2 diabetes, obesity, liver disorders, cardiovascular, heart failure, kidney failure, dyslipidemia, connected care, insulin space. So it's a pretty broad space of diabetes complications portfolio that we have.
And you lead a team of mostly statisticians now, is that right?
Yes, they're all project statisticians.
Okay. You've had this very interesting and diverse career path, right? And I think probably many people listening to this, especially statisticians, are maybe even thinking, wow, that is really a unique, you know, set of experiences you've had in your career. And, you know, in terms of what you learned along the way, was there any sort of any critical moment or critical moments in there where you learned something very important for your career, either to help you be better as a leader learn how to do something differently, or maybe it changed your thinking about how you do your work?
Actually, one of the things having all these different experiences taught me is to get outside my comfort zone, because I felt I was too sheltered when I was in statistics. And this helped me see things from the outside of the statistics organization into the statistics organization. So it was a huge learning curve for me, but it was great to see the other side where you're saying, you know, you're probably the recipient now from the statistics organization, or the people in your group are recipients, and you get to see, you know, what that looks like. So that was a critical thing. So getting out of the comfort zone is actually okay, because you will learn things that you may not foresee. But actually, there is a lot of return on investment in doing that. The second thing, actually, I felt very fortunate about this is, having come back to the statistics organization, I'm actually able to help the people in the organization, because now you have connections outside of the statistics organization. So if anybody wants a mentor or somebody outside, right, I can actually talk to the folks and say, hey, you know, I've got so-and-so in my group, and this is what their skill sets are, and this is what they're looking for, and would you be willing to be their mentor? So I can make those connections for the people in the group. That's been helpful. Plus, I also am able to give them the opportunities to go and share statistical thinking in other staff areas, because you know those people. And you're creating for the statisticians in your group a phone a friend once you have these connections. Because you are working on a project, and sometimes, you know, you may want to have a second opinion or with something, right? So you want to call somebody that you can trust outside, say, whether it's in the regulatory area or in the CMC area, you can actually call them and talk to them about it. So I feel like that's been really helpful, coming back to the stats organization to help the people in the group.
Did you have any difficult lessons you had to learn
I guess one of the things I would say is listening. I had to learn a lot about listening, because sometimes you can assume you think you know stuff, but when you actually listen, you'll see what you've actually missed. And I also learned that interacting with very different types of people, it takes a different set of thinking. You can't use the same method for everybody. It really depends on the person. So those were the, and I heard, I mean, these were like hard lessons for me to learn, because of course, obviously I made mistakes and, you know, it can come back to haunt you, but it was great at least to learn that. I'm still learning it.
Yeah, as statisticians, we tend to be typically very logical, oftentimes very blunt, right? Because we tend to get just to the facts. What's the facts? What's the data, right? And that doesn't always go so well when you get in areas where people aren't necessarily like that as much, you know, outside of statistics or even the sciences area. So,
and you actually begin to think like them because you're in that group. You can actually see where they are coming from. Actually, it's not so black and white once you're there.
Yeah, I think you're getting a broader perspective of, you know, what other people, how they see, even how they see the statistics function, right? And then you start to think like, wow, those statisticians, what's wrong with them? But so you've done this and you've had this really interesting career. And suppose there's some younger statistician out there and they have a thought that maybe I could do something outside of statistics. What advice would you give them?
I think it's a great idea if they wanted to do something outside statistics. I would say that, you know, whatever role that they're going after, for them to have a good understanding of what that role is and understand what kind of infrastructure is there in that role, because you're going outside your home, so to speak. And in order for you to be successful, you need to understand what kind of infrastructure exists there. And I also say that don't go for a role outside statistics if it's a promotion, just because it's a promotion. I mean, have a passion for it. I mean, you got to go with this 80-20 rule where, I mean, 20% of the time you have to do what you have to do. You know, all of us have stuff that we do in our jobs that we're not too thrilled about doing, but it's required for us to do. But 80% of the time, you know, having the passion to learn, to be flexible and, you know, be challenged and challenge others, right? So you've got to have that 80-20 rule. But I would definitely say don't take a role because it's a promotion. I did have an opportunity where actually I was given a promotion when I was in project management. I was offered a position that had a promotion. And I, you know, saw the role and I realized that in that role, you need to have somebody. It was a new position that was being created. And the role was so critically important that they had to show the return on investment on that role in 2 to 3 years. And as I read through the role and I saw that it required a certain field, somebody had to be really, really good in this particular field. And I knew I was not the person for it. And so I knew that sooner or later I was going to be unhappy and it's not going to be impactful for me nor for the company. So I didn't take on that role. And in fact, I told the person who had actually told me about this, I said, if I were me, I wouldn't hire myself. So just be careful about taking on a role just because it's a promotion.
Right. And it sounds like one thing that really helped you along this way was you seem to have some people that were pulling for you, that were your advocates along the way, right? And how important is that in terms of just general career? And then if you wanted to go along this path of moving outside statistics, how important is it having people that are your advocate or your mentors?
I think it is very important to have advocates. And I think, you know, there is a small difference between mentors and advocates. I think, you know, a mentor is going to guide you, to give you directions on specific things that you may ask them to give you directions on, or even in a career standpoint. An advocate is somebody who is going to be pulling out your name from their hat. When somebody says, here is an opportunity, and they say, hey, you know, I've got so-and-so in mind, this person's skill set is ABCD, they're really good at this. That's what an advocate is. And I think it's important to have that kind of an advocate. The reason is, where I sit, I may not see all the opportunities, right? But where my advocate sits, they may be able to see opportunities that I'm not even privy to. And they may say, hey, here is an opportunity for Shanti. So I think it is important. Now, to get an advocate, it's a two-way relationship. It is, you have to do some projects with them, for them, and then they can actually see how you're performing and what your skill sets are. So that's why I think that being a mentor cannot be a mentor. In order for the mentor to be an advocate, they should have actually worked with you.
Okay. That's a nice distinction and a nice way to think about it. If you could go back 20 years or 25 years and to talk to young Shanti, just starting in pharmaceuticals, what would you say to her?
I would first tell her not to be intimidated by chemists and engineers, because I made an assumption that they knew what they were talking about. So I didn't challenge them.
Be careful there. You might, hurt some people's feelings when you say
that. I know. But as a statistician, right, I think it is important to ask questions. I wish I didn't think that, is this a dumb question? And I was afraid to ask. I wish I was asking questions without feeling whether it was dumb or not, but just to say, okay, I'm going to ask because I need to learn. And when I learn, I can actually be more beneficial to the person that I'm working with than not. So that's one thing definitely I would say is I should have spoken up, asked questions, learned more about the big picture rather than just saying, okay, here is a design, I'm just going to go design it. Understand more about the process. I learned it over time where I actually went to the lab and actually saw them run the process so that I could actually see where the variability was coming from. So, just not sitting at your desk. So I wish I had done more of that much earlier on in my career. I mean, I learned it the hard way, but that's one of the things I would say is go out, learn the science, learn what they're doing, be in their field, in their area, so that, they feel like you're one of them and you build the trust. So that when you actually have to say something to them and say, or if you're giving them bad news about their data, they don't feel, slighted in any way. They are like, they trust you.
Do you think that this moving around and moving outside of statistics and taking on different roles, even within statistics, is that the right path for everybody?
No, I wouldn't say that is the right path for everybody. I think because I've known people who've stayed in their organization and grown up in their organization because of the depth that they wanted to have. And sometimes you can go faster up in an organization if you stay in that organization, because even within that organization, you could have different roles. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to necessarily leave the organization. For me, it was different because I really wanted to learn what was out there when I got the opportunity. And so I'm not feeling bad that I didn't stay in one place and grow up and climb up the ladder there. I'm actually a kind of person who loves to learn and make connections, and using these connections, being able to develop people. So it really depends on what your interest is, but it's not one size fits all at all.
Yeah, and I think that is true. There's lots of different ways to have a fulfilling and fruitful career, and I've been similar in my career. I've moved a lot in a lot of different roles. And I think in some ways you and I are similar in that we're curious, we like to learn. We have a little bit of an attitude and a chip on our shoulder sometimes where we think we can do better, maybe. And that's what also we want to go try and go in there and see, show people what we can do. And, other people are very good and very content and have great success just focusing on a specific aspect of a business, and I'm sure you have people on your team now that are just really, really good clinical statisticians. They've been doing it for a long time. And when the next project comes up, they just know what needs to be done. Right. And I think there's real value in that as well.
And they grow in that, and it's not mm-hmm. stagnant. I mean, there are so many nuances, right, in that role. And in that same role, you can grow because you start off by actually being part of a one-on-one. You start solving problems first when you start in your fresh out of school, right? Then you start joining a smaller team, and then you start joining a bigger project team you're influencing. Then you're influencing people from other functions, and then you could be influencing across therapeutic areas, right? So there is a lot that one can grow where they are. Like you said, it really depends on the person.
So one final topic, and this will be pretty broad, and we can talk about it as much as we want, but pulling out your crystal ball and trying to look into the future, what do you think the future holds for statistics functions and pharmaceuticals and statisticians and pharmaceuticals? And maybe over the next couple of decades? What's going to happen? What type of things are they going to be doing that are the same or different in the future?
So the pharmaceutical industry, I think it's a continuing field of opportunities for statisticians, and it's growing in all ways and shapes and forms. I mean, the breadth of impact for statisticians, it spans across various areas, starting from discovery, preclinical, clinical, non-clinical, development and manufacturing, post-launch, marketing. More and more now, statisticians are also getting involved with business analytics. And so it's not just the clinical area, it's also the business analytics area and the marketing area. And I think the regulatory environment is also changing to a great extent that the statisticians have a lot of opportunities there. And, you know, the FDA is very open about trying to come up with novel ways of doing it, innovative designs. Like, for example, we have a complex and creative design using a master protocol. I'm sure other companies are doing that too. That's one, you know, more innovation there, you can see. The amount and the type of data is growing, and also how to visualize the data. It's no longer in tables you're trying to put things. It's visualization is getting more and more out there because, it, like they say, you know, a picture can say 1,000 words, right? So especially when you're trying to look at how is your efficacy improving, for example, you can actually see it. Or how is your manufacturing process getting to be more in control and capable? There's a lot of visualizations you can do. The other piece that I've seen is also in the connected health, because there is a lot to do with digital technology coming up, and then that can collect reams and reams of data, and how do you manage that data? How do you look at the data, both from a clinical setting when you're actually doing a randomized controlled trial, whether you're doing an observational study or, you know, or real world evidence type of study. I mean, there is lots of data that's coming in, and how do you actually manage the data and pull out key information from the data, right?
What would be an example of a connected care situation? What?
So the ones that you would see mainly, and I'll talk from the diabetes standpoint since that's my field. So for example, you could have, you know, there are a lot of people out there with continuous glucose monitoring devices. It's like a patch that you put on your shoulder or wherever it is, and it's taking glucose readings every 5 minutes. And it could be then you may have a pump. Let's say you're a type 1 diabetic patient and you have a pump that has an insulin drug in it, right? And it can have an algorithm. So this data is being talked to the algorithm, and then the algorithm decides, hey, you know, should I give insulin or not? And how much should I give? And then all of this data now goes on to the cloud. So you have a patient who's actually got the continuous glucose monitoring, and their data goes up to the cloud, and the physician is sitting there on their seat, right? And they can pull up the data and say, hey, you know, hey, Jane, I need you to come in tomorrow because I'm looking at your data. So maybe we need to make some adjustments in your bolus insulin that you're going to take or something like that, right? So these people are actually looking at the data too. So you will get a lot of data coming in. So that's one example. I mean, there are so many other examples when it comes to digital technology for other diseases as well.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, in my mind is also enabling the patient to be able to see that data and get information from that for themselves as well. You know, that.
Yeah. Some people do want to do that, and they are actually tracking it. And I think that's very helpful for them because some people like to look at what's going on and make the changes, you know, whether they're going to be exercising and what they're eating and how is that eating impacting their insulin levels or glucose levels, I should say. So those are also, so it can be for the patients, it can be for the physicians too, yeah. And it could be for the caregiver too.
And it seems like that's also going to require a lot more collaboration across functional areas and across businesses because, you know, probably pharma companies aren't going to be making insulin pumps, right? There, another company, a medical device company is going to make that, right? And it's going to use the insulin that a pharma company makes as part of, you know, in the insulin pump. Same thing for the CGM, the continuous glucose monitor. That might be made by, you know, another company as well. and those have to talk to the pump, and you have to be able to figure out how you're going to get the data in the cloud. And so there's a lot more moving parts there that have to be coordinated and work together as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that also then brings the leadership qualities that will be helpful when the project statisticians have that, right? Because you're going to be interacting with all the people from the different fields. So it becomes even more important at this point in time, as we're talking about business acumen, for people to understand it. Because you'll be much more impactful and influential if you just spend a little bit of time doing it.
Yeah.
Right. It's not wasting time, but it's a little bit of time that's going to take you a long way.
Yeah. And I think as far as, you know, young statisticians, that as they progress in their career, I think the other thing that's changing is just the tools that are being used. That, you know, we're probably into this, I don't know, second era, third era of statistical tools, that where open source is becoming much, much more popular and accepted. You know, it'll be interesting to see the day when a pharmaceutical company does their whole clinical trial analysis and submission using open source tools, right?
Or seamlessly, you know, if the data can just flow seamlessly from the patient to the site to us across,
right.
You know, whether it's site data, whether it's lab data, and there's no issues, and you can and you do this in real time, right? It'll be awesome to be able to do that.
Yeah. So, and I can foresee that happening sometime in the next decade or two, right? That's going to happen, and that's, I think that's really exciting for people who are just getting into statistics right now. There's a lot of, it's not just stagnant. We're not just doing things the same way over and over again. There's a lot of innovation that's happening in the clinical area.
One thing, Sam, I would add is, and I know a lot of people would be, you know, very familiar with this whole concept of machine learning, artificial intelligence. You know, I'm sure that these words have been going around. I think a lot of this is also to be able to see, you know, with all of this existing data, can you come up with, you know, an intelligent algorithm, so to speak, that can actually help you predict, right? And this whole thing I was talking to you about, the CGM and the algorithm, right? It's part of that. It's, can you then predict what's going to happen based on the information from the individual person? Because this individualized, personalized medicine becomes critically important, right? So how do you go from, you know, looking at RCTs on the mean versus individual patients? And that's part of it, is the AI ML also comes into play, so that for an individual person, you're able to look at it. So there's a lot of opportunities for statisticians.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, yeah, I think that's great. And the future's pretty bright. And we are really, really happy that you were able to join us on the podcast. It's been a real,
well, thank you for having
real
me.
Pleasure to interview you. And, you know, I wish you all the best and continued success in what you're doing at Lilly in your career, and look forward to the next thing you're going to do, which might be something completely different. Who knows?
Yeah. Thank you so much,
right.
Sam. And thank you
very
much. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Head over to The Effective Statistician to find the show notes and much more content around the podcast and how you can boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.